Good evening. Welcome to 2020 and welcome to City Visions. I'm your host, Joseph Pache. Tonight, we look at the decade in architecture in San Francisco. 10 years can seem like a long time to watch a skyscape evolve, and San Francisco's has done so in its own unique way, with fits and starts and a fair amount of drama. Since 2010, we have seen a new skyscraper dwarf the city's previous tallest building. A futuristic-looking transit center finally opened after some major growing pains, and a previously desolate area of the city blossomed to host hospitals and a new sports arena. How is all this new construction fitting in with San Francisco's unique architectural history, and does it look to a vision of what San Francisco's skyline will be 10 years from now? Is our changing cityscape a sign of changes to the character of our city? And how do these new buildings and architecture in general play into San Francisco's ongoing struggle to address important social issues like homelessness, affordable housing, and global warming? Joining me here in the studio to discuss these issues and more are three guests who've been on the program before, and nice to have them all together this time. John King, urban design critic for the San Francisco Chronicle. He is author of the Cityscapes series and of a recent article, The Decade's Best Buildings in a Changing San Francisco, which we will talk about tonight. Welcome back to the program,
thanks,
John. And I just want to alert listeners, if they, given that radio is not a visual medium, although I imagine the descriptions that our guests will be making will help give people a picture in their mind, we have linked John's article to our website. So if you just go to the KLW homepage and scroll down to tonight's City Visions program, you'll find a link to John's article, which talks about 12 structures and spaces that redefined San Francisco in the last decade. So if you want to sort of watch along, so to speak, you can go ahead and do that. I also, in the meantime, want to welcome two other guests this evening, two architects whose buildings appear on John's list of the decade's best buildings. First, we have Anne Fougeron, founder and principal of Fougeron Architecture. Significant projects from that firm include Windsor at Dogpatch and the Avery in the Transbay neighborhood, both multifamily housing projects, and the Kapoor Center for Social Impact in Oakland. Welcome, Anne.
Thanks for having me.
And finally, we're joined by Stanley Sadowitz, principal of the Natoma Architects and professor emeritus of architecture at the College of Environmental Design at UC Berkeley. Significant projects include the multifamily 8 Octavia at the corner of Octavia and Market Streets and the 77-unit student housing complex Garden Village in Berkeley, as well as the first new condo to infill among the historic buildings of Pier 70. Welcome, Stanley.
Thank you.
And, of course, we invite you, our listeners, to join our conversation. We'll open our phone lines in about 20 minutes, but I'll give you that phone number now. It's 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. Or you can email us now at cityvisions@klw.org or tweet us at cityvisionsKALW. So I wanted to again start with you, John King, as I've done in past shows about architecture in the city. And I wanted to actually remind you of something you said in 2017 when you were last on this program, where you were talking about what had happened in 2016 and said that, you know, that was the year that SF MoMA, for example, opened.
It seems so long ago.
It does, right? And what you said there was that there was a lot of things that happened in architecture in San Francisco in 2016, but the important things, quote unquote, were still on the way. So here we are 3 years later. And with that in mind, I'm curious if you could give us some highlights from your article of things that you think were important enough to make your list and why they were. And as I remind our listeners, you can watch along if you just go to the homepage, KLW homepage, and click on our program, and you'll be able to see the link and the pictures in John's article in the Chronicle. So, John.
Well, one of the striking things, and it's hard to keep track of all this because we've been in this kind of hyper boom since 2012 that just keeps going. And you know, looking just the past few years, what fascinates me about the landscape in San Francisco is you've got all these simultaneous, very profound changes going underway. You've got big new towers that have redefined the skyline. And even if San Francisco is a city of neighborhoods, the skyline is still part of the visual image of any large city. At the same time, you've also got, and Anne worked on one of these kind of almost horizontal skyscrapers where you've got big chunks of land that traditionally were voids. They were industrial. They were parking lots. They were just kind of the in-between spaces. And trying to put a lot of new housing into established neighborhoods that you're not going to put towers in has created these buildings that might be 600 feet long. They might have 700 units in them. Ann's isn't that big, but am I correct? It was like the parking lot for the Hell's Angels or something like that, you know, in Dog Patch. So, you know, a piece of land that was off the map. Mm-hmm. Now all of a sudden Dog Patch is next to Mission Bay. Suddenly developers want to put things in. And so you start getting these almost horizontal towers. And then kind of a third piece to that is the whole, how do you kind of build neighborhoods and essentially do a 21st century take on the fabric that makes San Francisco distinctive among American cities, that it has, you know, not so much the big dramatic Chrysler buildings, but just the richness of the fabric. And that's where something like Stanley's 8 Octavia comes in. You know, it's the physical portal to Octavia Boulevard, and which kind of symbolizes all the planning that went into Hayes Valley. But it's also this very distinctive work of architecture, even though it's five or six stories and it's not that many units. You know, it's just like this sliver. And so you have these different levels. And then something we were talking about just before the show, what we forget is that early in the decade, there were the big plans being made, but there was also – it was a very quiet, slow time. And so you had things spark up, like you had a lot of young architects and like, let's turn a parking lot into a landscape. Let's – you know, and so you had a lot of the pop-up urbanism that has been kind of a – sub-theme to everything that's gone on since then.
And that would be like the parklets.
Exactly, mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So say more about some of these buildings that you've talked about. What caught your eye about them, and why did they make it to your list?
A list like that in a city like San Francisco does become to some extent a one of each. Like, okay, I want to put one tower on the list. Well, what tower? And the logical one, Salesforce Tower, for all it symbolizes, and I actually think it's a good work of architecture, just kind of inch by inch. But I also thought about one Ann was involved in, the Avery, which in a more kind of subtle, sophisticated way is this real neat serrated glass tower. But I went with 181 Fremont because it had a little bit of the swagger that you think of older skyscrapers, but in a very contemporary building. Purely as architecture, I don't think it's as good as some of the other towers that have been built. But just for like, well, you know, a skyline can be a thing of a little bit of drama and romance and fun. And that building captured it in a way a lot of others don't. Ann's building in Dog Patch, which has had a change of name to
12 times.
So whoever currently owns it in Dog Patch, Windsor?
The Windsor, yeah.
Oh, made it. Okay. Yeah. The Windsor in Dog Patch, I really like it with the – you're working with really kind of a squat box. So how do you variegate it? And she did it with just kind of a lot of fun moves that, you know, even if inch by inch they couldn't be realized the way an architect would have dreamed of in the absolute – They work well for mixing things up. And then there's a real good public space component that isn't grudging public space, but it's like genuine, well-designed public space by Fletcher Studio, who also did South Park. I liked the redesign of South Park, even though I liked the old South Park too. Mm-hmm. You know, so a lot of it was just kind of that, like, well, what's a cultural building that ought to be in the mix? And rather than some of the bigger obvious candidates, I went with the Land's End Visitor Center that the GGNRA did, just because it's such a good piece of work of architecture. And it got done around 2012, so I think people have forgotten about it. You know, so it's just trying to get a little bit of a mix of things in there. Some affordable housing. We're lucky we have a lot of different good affordable housing projects in the city. And I went with one that's at 6th and Howard that Owen Kennerly did, or Kennerly Architecture, which is a real good building, but it's also a real good building in a location that needs a real good building. But that could have been another one too.
And so tell me, when you talk about public space a little bit more, let's stay with that for a moment. So you've mentioned that Anne's project, Windsor at Dogpatch, brought in public space. The Transbay Transit Center mm-hmm. obviously is a public space, and then on top of it has a rooftop garden. Tell us how public spaces evolved in the architecture that you saw in the last decade.
I think the public space has evolved in mostly good ways. It is – there's a lot more smartness about how do you make a space work. It's not just how do we make a space that looks really good for when the architecture firm sends out the architecture photographer to shoot that. And if it's the landscape architecture doing the shot, they bring in a few kids and a few attractive 27-year-olds to spontaneously enjoy the space. But I think just kind of a certain sensibility of how do you mix up the space? How do you, you know, to what extent is it an artistic piece and to what extent is it more a user space? And again, I think that's mostly been for the better. And I think it's been real interesting to me to the reaction to the rooftop park at the Transit Center. The Transit Center and Salesforce, the name Salesforce, are such an easy thing to kind of hook critiques of the city, of the current city on. So any New York critic or any New York writer who comes out, that's where they're going to go for their Wither San Francisco piece. And then the park becomes very good because then it's this unreal world that's separated from the dirty streets below and everything like that. Probably Tucker Carlson on Fox News will stop by to sneer at it and then find it somebody shooting up like down in the shadows of it. But the surveillance issues are very real, but it's something like at the Transit Center, the people I see there using it love it. Everyone I talk to loves it. And if you actually just sit and watch people walk by, it's a more varied group than can kind of be pinned down. I mean, you definitely get a lot of tech workers in the nearby tech-filled office buildings walking around. But I see guys who look like they're homeless there. I see couples who are meeting there just to meet. You know, you see kids there. So it's tough. A city like San Francisco is really wrestling with the desire for public spaces versus the concerns about public spaces. And that's going to continue.
So, yeah, I wanted to turn to you, Stanley, and Anne to speak to some of the points that John made in terms of as you've worked in this city for a number of decades, how have you what kinds of pressures have you been under in terms of trying to balance what, you know, what you're being asked to do with what the city perhaps is wanting you to do and how clear that is to you in the first place, you know, either from the person who's paying you or from people who are going to be walking by or using your spaces. How what's that dialogue like between between you and the various stakeholders that pin a lot of expectations on what you build?
You know, the stakeholders are often at first quite skeptical about any change. But what I've really enjoyed is that once the buildings do get built, you know, they change their opinions and their minds about things. And, you know, the sort of intensification that's gone in the city is the most pleasurable thing for me. I mean, just how even in the older neighborhoods, you know, like, say, Hayes Valley or Divisadero, you know, public space has really taken on just by the new intensity of use that's happened. So the density and kind of evolution of the city, not just new buildings, but also the older neighborhoods, has been really fun in the last 10 years. I mean, I lived in Hayes Valley 10 years ago, and it was a kind of sleepy street with, you know, yoga studios and a dry cleaner. And if you go there today, it's just an incredibly intense place that people hang out, and, you know, it's a center of the city.
Mm-hmm. And you, Anne?
No, I agree. I think it's easy to criticize both the process of getting buildings done in San Francisco and the process of living here and this and that, but I think the way the city has changed in the last 10 years and the opportunities that it's afforded for people to find places to live and for things to do is just amazing. And it's transformed the city, and I think in really good ways. And so while I know we have huge issues that are not just in San Francisco but really exist probably nationwide of homelessness and poverty and difficult middle class issues, I also think that we have tried as a community to make the city better for everybody to live in if we can. And it's not an easy problem to solve. So I think that that's really been great. I mean, I had a house in Noe Valley, and Dolores Park, right, was absolutely like the worst place in the world. Like, it was a drug haven with people shooting each other and stuff like that. I mean, look at it now, right? I mean, who would have believed it? I would have never believed it when I first moved into that neighborhood. And to see these spaces rediscovered by people who live in the city and finding value to them, I mean, that's what a city is really about. I mean, that's where you want to meet. That's why you live in a city, right? You don't live in a city to hide in your apartment all day. Well, you can, but most people. And then in terms of the process of getting buildings built, what can I say? The process of getting building builds just gets more complicated every single year, every single decade. And I don't see it getting any simpler. There's so many stakeholders, both citywide, but also people who own properties, and also what it costs to build, and also the neighbors, and environmental issues. And all those issues are all good, but they don't all work together. And that's the real problem, and I think that's a frustration that people find, right, that everybody's trying to get something done, and sometimes you're meeting these walls and you're meeting up this resistance because people are at odds in terms of what they think is the right solution to the problem. It's not never easy.
So with all these multiplicity of demands, has your job gotten more frustrating, more interesting, because there's just so many more intersections to try to – or knots, I should say, to try to deal with. What's it been like?
A combination of both. I think in a way it's more interesting because there's a level of complexity, and also we're getting to do bigger buildings. So there is a sense of kind of, you know, breaking yourself into that world and really having an impact on your city and beyond this city. But at the same time, it's also a feeling like things are taking a really long time. And in a place where things want to move because we need more housing, for example, if we're going to just talk about housing, or we need to get things done more quickly just to keep up with cost, it is frustrating. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's no doubt about it. So it's a little bit of both, right? I mean, this kind of incredible sort of I mean, I always say, you know, the world of architecture, we're in the tech world and it's just flying out the door. And then the world of architecture is a glacial world, right, because everything moves so slowly and it takes so long to get something done. And putting those two worlds together is constantly frustrating for people because they're like, just can't believe it, right? They're like, how can it take this long? But it does.
So Stanley, pick up on that. Mm-hmm. How has the tech explosion mm-hmm. impacted the architectural process, the tensions mm-hmm. it's created, the potential for innovation, if mm-hmm. any. What have you seen there?
You know, I don't see them overlapping as much as I'd really hope they would. I mean, we have this amazing population. You know, I'm in the middle of, like, mid-market, and when I go to lunch now, everyone's sort of, like, under 27, mm-hmm. speaking in all different kinds of languages. And, I mean, the new population in the city is incredibly diverse and intense. And, you know, one would hope that would sort of create a less conservative idea about the community and offer new opportunities. But, you know, I think the difficulty that we have of getting our work done is also what keeps the pleasure of actually finally getting to build something so incredible. You know, we do have a really wonderful job. I mean, I'm sure the people in tech feel the same kind of thrill about the invention of things, but our work of actually like creating something that didn't exist, you know, that you start with a flat piece of emptiness, and then, you know, over months and months of work, suddenly this thing emerges. And so despite the difficulty, the pleasure and the joy of being able to do this work sort of makes it all worthwhile.
So, John, what do you have to say about the intersection or lack thereof between tech and architecture? How have they influenced each other, if at all, or are they kind of two different pursuits that are very different?
I kind of agree with Stanley. I think they're pretty separate in this area. I mean, it's funny that the whole kind of iPhone sleek design mentality has so percolated into a lot of basic design goods and things. And buildings, you get some of that, but it tends not to really overlap too much, because in a city like San Francisco, you know, every district has its urban design standards, its contextual standards. And I think, I mean, I've been doing this for too long. Feel like I'm 100 years old some days. One of the things I like about San Francisco, it is really loosened up a lot in that there's much more openness to good, creative, fresh design. I mean, the idea that Anne and that Stanley are working at the scale both of you are working, and with the number of projects you've worked on, I mean, that is much different than, I mean, when I started, Stanley had just done Yerba Buena Lofts, which was a very controversial project, and it was a big project. But I think you guys were mostly kind of known for, you know, exquisite private homes, good spaces for nonprofits, things like that. And to see architects like this being hired by big developers who want to kind of make the building work locally and have kind of good local credentials is a good thing. But I don't know if the tech piece has come in, you know, like the last 5 or 6 years. I keep hearing modular housing is the future, you know, in particular that. And people are starting to use it, I think, just out of concern over cost. But I don't know that that starts to break into freeing up architects to be more creative, or if it's just a way to kind of pull down some of the costs, you know, where you just basically stack a lot of things together and punch holes in them for the hallway.
But, you know, I'm always asking myself about how, you know, we could start doing buildings in the way that, say, Elon Musk has rethought the automobile. And, you know, like when you think about the Model 3, I mean, I'm trying to think about bathrooms or kitchens that are as kind of discreet and magical, you know, where all the dials and gadgets are gone. I mean, there are these push-button showers, you know, so the inspiration of technology is there, but our industry's very conservative and slow to, you know, accept these new technologies.
And I imagine there's also the fact that, you know, the physicality of what you build just has to work and has to play by certain rules and regulations.
Which are quite long and tedious sometimes. Yeah, that's the other thing. So you just, you know, and the larger scale you have, the more you kind of go into this world where people are really used to doing things one way, and getting them to do it another way is sometimes like incredibly difficult. And you're like, but why? It doesn't matter, right? But that's just the way that's the way it's always been, and that's the way it has to work, right? So I think trying to get things to change as quickly as you might for an iPhone design just doesn't happen, right? There's just so many other factors that kind of get in the way.
So not referencing your ages at all, but it does. But you did mention your
100
your
years old,
100. Your felt age.
But a sprightly 100.
Yeah. You know, what's interesting about the tech industry is that it's about young disruptors, and what I'm hearing here is that architecture is not necessarily a disruptive type of pursuit, and there's a lot of conservatism within it that might come with the generational differences, or that might come from other reasons.
I would think a lot of that. I mean, I would think a lot of that would be that, you know, architects are at the mercy of their clients, and they're at the mercy of existing building codes and things like that. And they're at the mercy of a cost model that wants the ledger to balance out. I don't think either one of you are getting calls from venture capitalists saying, here's $100 million, do a really cool building, and then we'll exponentially ramp it up to scale and we'll take off and we'll go public.
But, you know, there are real shifts that have mm-hmm. happened. I mean, in the last 10 years, for example, like in our practice, we used to do, say, a two-bedroom unit at 1,300, 1,400 square foot. Mm-hmm. Right now, the two-bedroom units that we're doing are 650 square foot. So there's been a kind of, compaction of the way people inhabit space in the city. It's got many, many sort of aspects to it, you know, cost and just availability. But there's definite significant change that's happened in the way that we work.
I want to reintroduce the program. This is City Visions on local public radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco, and on the web at KALW.org. I'm Joseph Pache, and tonight we're discussing the decade in architecture in San Francisco with John King, urban design critic for the San Francisco Chronicle, Anne Fougeron, principal of Fougeron Architects, and Stanley Sadowitz, principal of Natoma Architects. We invite you, our listeners, to call in with your questions and comments. What are your favorite buildings of the decade? Do you have thoughts about how new structures are playing into the city's attempts to address important issues like homelessness, housing, and climate change, which topics we'll get to in the second half of the hour? We invite you to join our conversation by dialing 866-798-TALK. Again, that's 866-798-8255. You can also email us at cityvisions@klw.org or tweet us at cityvisionsKALW. So I wanted to point out that no one so far has mentioned the Chase Center. Why not?
It's a big, slick building. I mean, it's good for what it is.
Yeah. That's it. How about this the public space aspect of it, or the attempt to create a sort of help it be sort of a hub right. in a neighborhood that's still trying to find its bearings?
I give the Warriors real credit for that. I think they very genuinely are trying to think about how do we make this into something more than a venue with space around it. But I think the test on that is going to be 2 or 3 years off when built spaces fill in nearby, and then it will be, does that kind of become the town square where Mission Bay meets Dogpatch? Or is it essentially empty except for people who go to the restaurant at lunch and on game nights or concert nights or whatever? Because the thing about the Transit Center rooftop park, there was such a latent population there wanting an extravagant open space. You know, there are so many workers around it. 3rd and 16th Street isn't exactly a hub of activity right now.
Mm-hmm. But there's a critical mass
there's a lot coming.
Development that will give it a right. population yeah. and intensity.
I mean, the thing that I think is the most exciting in San Francisco right now is this kind of development south, right, when we're just kind of taking back all this land that had been forgotten, really, and a lot of it was actually dangerous or unhealthy and stuff like that. And now you can walk, you know, for miles down that along the waterfront, and you can go by the Chase Center, and you can keep going. And I think that that's going to become a great new kind of place to be in San Francisco. But I think it's still like half under construction and not right. finished, and there's stuff, you know, coming out, and you have to go left, to go right, to go. So that still disrupts, you know, the use of it. So I think, and I agree with you, you have to wait to see, because it makes sense where it is in terms of being the next place to take you down. But whether or not it's going to be that great place or not, I'm still having a hard
time
figuring
out. But there are like three office buildings,
right.
large
right.
office buildings, and then also like a medical office right. building all under construction on the site or across the street. You know, a year, yeah. 18 months from now, those are all filled with people.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's true.
And then let's talk about some other things that we mentioned mm-hmm. earlier in the program and earlier in the decade, or last decade, when we talked about them. now that we're, you know, a number of years away from the SF MoMA expansion, how are people looking at that space? Yet again, another cultural space, a public space, and in a place that's quite dense. Have people's thoughts about that space changed over time?
No, dead air, so I'll jump in. I did a column earlier, I was going to say earlier this year, last year, on SF MoMA and BAMFA. And in a way, it's an unfair comparison. They both opened around the same time. However, one's much bigger than the other. But I think with time, I've been disappointed in SF MoMA. I think it's a little like Chase Center. It does a very good job at what it sets out to do. But really good cultural buildings just have this added resonance and this added experience and sense of discovery, almost like a cabinet of curiosities thing, no matter how big it is. And SF MoMA, to me, and you guys should disagree if you want, just hasn't delivered a lot more than kind of what was obvious a month after it opened. Whereas BAMFA, it just works really well with the different exhibits there, and you kind of get to know spaces, but you also notice how much those spaces can be altered pretty subtly. And I don't know.
The excitement about SF MoMA was, you know, it peaked and dropped off very fast. Mm-hmm. The conversation just disappeared about the building. I think the institution and the sort of extent of it and having so much space has allowed much better exhibitions and shows. But, you know, it's not really an excitement about the actual architecture. It's more the way it's being used.
And why is that?
I think it was an incredibly difficult problem. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think trying to add this enormous amount of square footage to a building that, you know, is not easy to add to because it's this extremely sort of centered, hierarchical sort of just building, and then you're trying to build this big thing on top of it. And I think it shows. I mean, I think it still shows. It feels awkward. You know, you go into the old building and you're like, and so the thing doesn't resonate. And I think you're right. You just don't go there and feel like it all sort of comes together. I totally agree that there have been some great shows there and that the additional space has been sort of wonderful. And it's mm-hmm. really helped get some pretty amazing things that are really nice to be a part of in the city. But I think architecturally it's a bit of an awkward
China, you know, I think yeah. MoMA in New York suffered from that for a while until Taniguchi came and he kind of joined it all together. Maybe the next project for SF MoMA will be to take the two buildings and make them into a single museum. Because now we've got two museums, a red one and a white one.
Right.
And, you know, I think it would be great if somebody could come and actually combine them.
He needs a third remodel.
So going back to what stood out for you in terms of architectural successes in the last decade, I had John name a number of his favorites. How about yours? What stood out for you?
You know, for me, it's not about individual buildings as much as the transforming of the city that's been going on. And, I mean, you know, the new neighborhoods that have developed, mid-market, which I know is still fledgling and, you know, is, I mean, I think now again with the current buildings, there's going to be the sort of intensity that will start to transform it. But, you know, I think the same with Rincon and, you know, like the project that Anne's involved with, like that whole area just becoming a live part of the city. They were places that, you know, just like in Los Angeles, like downtown was derelict and you never bothered to go there. Suddenly there are these new hubs in San Francisco where you can take your friends and hang out and, you know, which for me is the best part of the city. But in terms of, you know, individual works of architecture, it's more difficult for me. I mean, I feel the success of the city has more been in its growth in chunks rather than individual buildings.
Mm. Anne?
I agree, but I also, I think Stanley's 8 Octavia was a fantastic building. I mean, I think that there have been really beautiful buildings in the city. I mean, Owen Kennerly's Kennerly Architecture's affordable housing project also on 6th Street. So I see these gems, but I also really gravitate towards, you know, things like what happened to Hayes Valley, right? Like, I mean, Hayes Valley was just a complete mess until they finally tore down that freeway and got all those sites, you know, filled in and developed, which is how you got your building, which is how we did a building there too, a couple actually. And the same thing with the Transbay neighborhood, like all of a sudden taking something that was left over, what I call scar sites, you know, these sites that have just been left over because a freeway got torn down or some warehouse fell apart or something, and filling them in with this incredible amount of density and just seeing a whole neighborhood being transformed. I mean, that's what makes a great city. So within that, you find great buildings. But even in New York, they're not all great buildings, right? Let's be fair, right? A lot of them are just these background buildings, and that's fine, right? And you, what you're really looking for is just a level at which you can interact with, be a part of this kind of growing, sort of vibrant community. And I think that that's really happening.
I think Hayes Valley is a good example because I, in putting together the list, I had Stanley's 8 Octavia because it's a really good building, but also it's like kind of the one to pull out in Hayes Valley. But you know, as Stanley was saying, there's so much activity there. But then if you do step back and stand around, like walk around Hayes and Gough Street, I think it's Gough, there's so many really striking buildings. Anne did a great little one. David Baker has like two or three within a block of each other.
One on each corner.
And one's like an one's like supportive housing and then the others, you know, like condominiums. But I think that that's the kind of thing that can start to loosen attitudes a bit where it's like, hey, I wouldn't mind a new building in my neighborhood if it's a cool building like that. Right. I mean, the challenge is to then get it built. But
which kind of leads me to the next part of the discussion, which is, you know, so far we've talked about the parts where there's been room to build and there's been less you know, roadblocks to increasing density compared to the western half of the city, right? Do you, in some ways, it's going to, like you said, it's two museums next to each other. Is it two cities next to each other, this very dense built scape compared to the, you know, sleepier and lower height and density western part of the city? Or do you see the possibility that things will loosen up in that way as well, John and the rest of you, of course? Or is that a bigger problem that's going to take a lot longer to
I don't think you're fix? Going to see Salesforce Towers' cousin built out at, you know, like 14th and Noriega or something like that. But, you know, the western neighborhood is dense by regular city standards. I mean, those are a lot of teeny little single-family homes packed in together in two- and three-unit buildings. I would think and I would hope that what you'll see in the next decade is more of an openness to the idea that, you know what, if Irving Street has six- or eight-story buildings along it, that's fine. If Judah has that, that's fine. If Clement Street and Gary start to build up, that's fine. I mean, I think that there's such a generational shift going on in the city where a lot of people here kind of a certain age and mentality. It's like we fought all the battles in the 70s and 80s and we stopped Manhattanization and we stopped evil developers and all. And they're still offended at the idea of growth. But a lot of younger people are like, well, I want a little excitement in things. And I think that you could see those neighborhoods start to kind of step up their density, I would hope so.
And you mean on basically on commercial corridors?
Yeah.
I think that's true. We're doing a project on Mission, you know, pretty far down Mission. It's going to be one of the first condo projects built in that neighborhood in decades. And I think this is really important. But, you know, I also have my office in North Beach, and God, could that use a little. And, you know, and that's, we know why that doesn't happen there, right?
North Beach is a world unto itself.
Yes,
that's
exactly.
What makes it so charming.
Yes.
But it's getting lost in time. I mean, it was such a great part of the city. When I first came here, that was the city. Mm-hmm. And now you can live for years without going near it.
Exactly. You know, I mean, all the storefronts are gone.
Well, how about the subway? It's going to take everyone there, no?
Yeah. Maybe. Exactly. We're hoping.
When it gets done.
When it gets
God,
done.
God, it's so great. It's like...
These projects like, Venice Avenue and the subway that, in China, those things happen within like 6 months and they finished. And they've
Are they safe, though?
I don't know. But they're fast.
But they're fast. Yeah.
I mean, we're slow to do that kind of stuff, this infrastructure stuff in this country and frankly in California and the way we built that bridge. The Bay Bridge should be a perfect example of how not to do it. You know, so I mean, we've watched infrastructure projects of that complexity and much nicer, resulting in much better bridges. For example, the Millau Bridge in France, which I'm very familiar with because I grew up there, and which cost a tenth, I think, well, $400 million versus
$2.8 billion
or
$6 billion.
I mean, as complex. Way more beautiful, done, designed by Norman Foster, finished. And now here we are with that bridge and still kind of finding bolts that are rusting or something. It's just ridiculous. So, I mean,
it's frustrating that, the central subway, the high-speed rail has had its problems, but I think it's been beat on so much. And meanwhile, the central subway is in this bizarre limbo that just goes on. So when
that
the city
sort of falls under the radar.
Exactly. Yeah. Or the Van Ness bus corridor. It's just anyone who goes on Van Ness. And it's like, when did this start? 2000?
Yeah, exactly.
Well, we've been talking about it in 10 more years. It's strange that the city loves grand plans, but the basic nuts and bolts of making things work kind of fall through the cracks sometimes.
This is City Visions on Local Public Radio 91.7 KALW San Francisco and on the web at KALW.org. I'm Joseph Pache. We're talking with John King of the San Francisco Chronicle and Anne Fougeron and Stanley Sadowitz, two architects here in San Francisco, about the decade in architecture here in San Francisco. Again, putting out the phone number if you'd like to join our conversation, 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can also email us at cityvisions@kalw or tweet us at cityvisionskalw. So we have an email from Michael. It says, it was 2008, but Sadowitz's congregation Beth Shalom on 14th Avenue is one of my favorite buildings. I'd love to hear how he came up with this design. Timely as it was or not at the time.
I'll just be very brief because it's a long story. But there was a wonderful rabbi who led that congregation who had the sort of courage and spirit to help me to make that building possible. And it's really a testament to just, an incredible working relationship with someone who was a real visionary. And the first time, that he came to my office to look at my very first drawing, he fell in love with it. And he just was the magic that made it happen.
Hmm. So we're going to have to take a really hard left here after talking about sort of what's been going well, what's loosening up, what's still quite staid and stuck, to talking about how architecture converses with some of the other insoluble problems in our city, homelessness and housing shortages or affordable housing. How do you think about that, those types of problems, and where do you see architecture's place in being part of a solution here? Or is it has nothing to do with architecture? It has to do with all sorts of other things that architects have no control over.
I think it's very much has to do with architecture. And I think one of the dangers right now is that the debate can become so acrimonious that, like, I did a tweet. I live in Berkeley, and I went by. I was waiting for a bus, and I'm staring at this awful five-story building. Fill in the blank. You've all seen it if you've been in Bay Area cities, built on the cheap about 5 years ago. And I tweeted a photo, and the response was pretty much, that's what's wrong with this region. It's a bunch of old people who just hate seeing new housing built. And it ought to be 10 stories tall. And then the next tweet's like, it ought to be 20 stories tall. And, you know, it's a problem. If you ignore architecture, you get a lot of junk built. And then people are like, well, why should I let more junk be built? And meanwhile, other people are saying no building's a good building unless it's 40 stories tall and it's a big slab filled with apartments. And, I mean, the trick is how do we – or not how do we, but how do architects and planners find efficient, livable, good ways to continue growing within the constraints of the city? I think it's critical because if the stuff that gets built is not good, you're building in – the material for a counter reaction in a year or two.
You know, the problem of homelessness and how we might go about thinking about it is that our cities are incredibly poorly used. The amount of space that we have in our cities is not properly used. You know, we talked. John mentioned the parklet as a way where you would occupy for the public use a parking space. I mean, there's a huge amount of space in cities that is dedicated to storing cars, for example. Like those kinds of spaces could be converted into living spaces mm-hmm. for people. Half the garages in San Francisco are full of junk. Mm-hmm. They don't even have cars in them. Exactly. I mean, what if those types of – so, you know, I don't think it's necessarily only about building more shelter. It's also about the way that we take the resources that are wasted in our society and figure out better ways to use it. And, you know, I just think we have to be much more radical about the way we think about solving this problem. It's a huge problem. I mean, I live in an area where my walk to work for two blocks, you know, I stumble over like 5 to 10 bodies every morning. I mean, it's heartbreaking for me, and I find it really hard to live like this. I really do. Mm-hmm. So I think we've just got to really put our heads together and figure out how to find solutions.
What do you think, Anne?
I agree. I mean, listen, I work on a lot of affordable housing, and I have to say that probably San Francisco is one of the most aggressive, well-organized affordable housing sort of nonprofits developing affordable housing and getting it built in the city, and they've done an incredible job, right? I mean, there's a really lot of really good buildings. So even in the Transbay, you know, the two buildings we worked on, one of them has a 22% affordable housing component, and the other one has a 27% affordable housing component. That's pretty high. And I think that this is what you need to do, and we need to do more of that. Listen, Mission Rock is going to have a 40% affordable housing component. I mean, that's huge, right, to develop by the giants, et cetera. So I think we have to keep working on that front because I think the more we can get this housing built and the more we can get people off the streets, I mean, it's a well-known fact. I mean, if you get people off the streets and you give them a temporary shelter, that then they can kind of find a way into a society, you know, that's the first step, right? It's essential. The navigation centers, I think, are a great idea. And I agree with you. I mean, we have to just kind of pool all these resources as much as possible. I mean, there are buildings that are empty that should never be empty. There's a lot of stuff out there that becomes a stumbling block. But I think getting people off the street should be fundamentally, absolutely our first mm-hmm. priority, because nobody needs to live like they do anywhere in mid-market or south of market or stuff like that. It's just not humane in any way. So I think we have to recognize that San Francisco actually very aggressively pursues these things. There's just so much more that we can do and that we have to do faster, I think, because the problem, you know, kind of mushroomed because of this problem with the middle class and people losing their jobs and then, you know, and rents going up high. And then all of a sudden, you know, you don't pay rent 1 month and you're kicked out. And then all of a sudden you have nothing left. Right. I mean, people are just one paycheck away from basically losing their housing. Right. So it's a real problem.
But it is tough. The new housing yeah. costs so much. I mean, even
yes, exactly.
I talked with these efforts to pull it down. Can we get it built so we're building the homeless units for under $500,000, yeah. things like that.
No, it's really a problem with the cost. Yeah. Yeah. There's no doubt about it. And that's, you know.
Well, we have a call from Ariel, I believe. Mm-hmm. Ariel?
Yes.
Is that how you pronounce your name? Yeah.
Ariane, thank you.
Oh, Ariane, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you. I work with the homeless and the indigent, and I think these are very complex problems, but what concerns me very much in this city is that you have developer-driven even housing bills that circumvent environmental regulations to build housing actually for the ultra-wealthy, and they have like just a smattering of below-market rate units for people who make over $80,000. It's really ravaging the city, and they're using sort of like the wolf in sheep's clothing. They're using the logos and the rhetoric to promulgate even like clear-cutting of our forests and our trees and things like that. That's the first thing I want to say. And then I want to say something also that seems very, perhaps the opposite of that, but I think that all space is public space in a certain way. So anyone who goes down a street and sees a building, that's part of what we all partake of. And so there should be regulations that all buildings have an architect involved, because we're all looking at the buildings. And when you have a cheaply created rendition by a company or a developer that wants to maximize its profit, all of the rest of us are left witnessing and partaking of that structure for years, decades. It's just not fair. And we need to really reconvey and reconfigure how we understand property, who owns what, and what public space is. Because otherwise, it's just an imposition. And often the people who have the most money are determining what is right for the rest of us. And that's a lot of people who are very young in this city, you know, who are in their 20s making over $100,000 a year. And they're determining with, you know, very perhaps with less maturity than a lot of older people what the course of our society and civilization or lack thereof is looking like in the near future and the far future.
Thanks so much for your call. John, would you like to comment?
Yeah, just real quick. I mean, that kind of gets back to what I was talking about a little bit. I mean, one reason I started writing about architecture and got interested in architecture as a history major at UC Berkeley is that, I mean, we are creating the world we live in. And the buildings that go up about around us, the spaces that go up around us that we inhabit, I mean, that does determine kind of the shared quality of life. I mean, realistically, some buildings will be for the wealthy. Some buildings will be for the poor. Not every building is going to solve every problem. However, it's how do they all fit together and how does the mix work out? But it also needs to be a mix that you want to be in. I mean, if San Francisco had pursued some of the urban design plans of the 1950s and 60s, it would not be San Francisco. People wouldn't want to live here. And if we decided, well, let's just, you know, North Beach is stodgy, so let's just plow it all down and put in a bunch of 24-story apartment buildings, suddenly you don't have North Beach anymore. You know, it's like you have this thing that's near a diagonal boulevard, and it's like, whatever happened to North Beach? Yeah. So there, that's the challenge, is how do you grow, but how do you grow in a way that is making the place better for the future.
And what do you make of this idea that that Ann and Stanley are talking about, which is that there is a lot of space that needs to be reclaimed and repurposed?
I think we've seen that the last 10 years almost physically in terms of pieces of property and things like that. You know, it kind of Ann talked about kind of the scar spaces. I think about the void spaces. You used to walk from a neighborhood to a neighborhood, and there were four or five blocks in between of whatever it was. You forgot about it. Now those all have like these 6 or 8 story housing complexes on them. But it is tricky. How can you start to look at built structures and like a parking garage, like a self-storage building? How can you do things and cleverly economically convert them into different types of living that might not be your ideal but would be a lot better for people than being on the street and something like that?
You know, the reality is that to build a building right now, it costs between save $400 and $700 per square foot. That's just the resources and human energy that's involved. That's just construction. There's a whole lot of other costs as well, which so, you know, it just takes like the sort of affordable housing and the efforts to build new housing for people is limited by just resources that are available. You just need vast amounts of money to be able to build enough housing, which is why I think we have to try to find other interim kind of opportunities. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we can't build. I mean, I know we have millions and millions of dollars dedicated to, you know, homelessness, but it just wouldn't be able to even make a dent in the amount of houses that we need.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's true. I mean, I that's why I think actually things like the navigation centers, which, God, were so controversial in my neighborhood. I live on the Embarcadero near the ferry building, and my neighborhood just fought that so bitterly, including people in my building.
talking about the navigation center.
And I was like, the biggest complaint I hear from everybody in that neighborhood is, oh, the homeless, they've taken over. We don't feel safe. You know, it's a bunch of more elderly people, not 100 years old, but close. and I'm saying, well, this, the biggest problem you have can be helped by creating this navigation center, which is also temporary, which I love. I mean, the idea that, you know, it's here for a while, you don't need any more, you know, take out the air, move it on, you know, is really a good idea. And I just can't. And it's often in these sites that are unused, you know, and they're kind of somewhat like, used by cars. And, God, the controversy of this city about those was amazing to me, because we're sort of like saying one thing and then...
Yeah, I went to look at the navigation center last week, and I'm going back again this week. And I know I got there and it's like, wait, they only used half the parking lot for this? They could put in another 200 beds. But probably that was the political fight.
It was a political site, And hopefully once it's in there long enough, you know, that people will get used to it and just, you know, they'll just be able to add another piece of it and nobody will notice in the dead of the night.
So in the, like, minute we have left, if we're around this table in 10 years, what would be something you would say, wow, I'm so glad we accomplished this. This is what we needed, and I never thought we could.
Well, I'll reframe it. I would be fascinated if 10 years from now I say, wow, I can't believe so much got built on Treasure Island, and I can't believe that Pier 70 is done.
Anne?
I can't believe we actually got the Caltrain station all the way to the Transbay terminal.
Okay. All right.
You know, I just...
What you get John, the last word.
What John said, both Anne and I are working on Treasure Island, and I'm working at Pier 70. And I think these reclaimed pieces that are going to become new hubs of the city and, you know, intense, dense new places to be are really exciting. And there's a whole bunch of them. You know, the ones down south like India Basin. I mean, all over the city, there are these new pieces of San Francisco that are developing. And the city can accommodate and spread and have all of that as part of what it is.
All right, so we have a date for 10 years from now. We'll be celebrating your 110th birthday, John. I want to thank my guests for joining me this evening, John King, urban design critic for the San Francisco Chronicle, Anne Fougeron, principal at Fougeron Architects, and Stanley Sadowitz, principal of Natoma Architects. Thanks for joining me this evening.
Thanks for having us.
For a link to this and other City Vision shows, to let us know what you thought about tonight's program, to subscribe to alerts and download podcasts, visit the City Visions page at klw.org. Our engineer this evening was David LaTulipe. Tonight's show was produced by Chris Nooney. Join me next Monday as we look at the current immigration debate in the context of the experience of Japanese American immigrants leading up to World War II. This is Joseph Pache. Thanks for listening. Good night. Have a great week.